You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
More than 8 years into the war in Afghanistan, whether and how to pursue negotiations with the Taliban is the question on many people's minds. From Hamid Karzai's government to Washington policy circles and beyond. So it might be a good time to try to understand the Taliban side of the story. Abdul Salam Zaif, the former ambassador of the Taliban government to Pakistan and a major figure in the movement, has written an autobiography that offers an unprecedented look into the Taliban worldview. My Life with the Taliban is being published by Columbia University Press, and Alex Strick Van Linschoten and Felix Kuhn, independent researchers who live in Kandahar, join me now to discuss the book. Welcome to our show. Hi.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listed as the book's editors. You're also its translators?
Not so much. The way the book came into being, initially there was a text which we had translated from by people we were working with, and then we worked with him to kind of shape that and develop it into the English version.
So you, Felix, you helped him actually create this book, write his own autobiography?
It was a pretty involved process of getting this together. I mean, he wrote an initial script in Pashto, which we translated, and on the basis of that, we had hours and hours of interviews with him to elaborate on points. Like what we did more or less was a cultural translation. For a lot of people in the West, they don't know the places in southern Afghanistan.
And had he started writing this on his own, Alex?
Absolutely.
But then he obviously wanted people in the West to also read it, so he was amenable to your suggestions, and you're helping him shape it.
I mean, initially he'd written a book about his time in Guantanamo, and it was only after further extensive discussions with him that it came out that he'd written, in fact, 11 or 12 other books about various things, and this was one of them.
Uh-huh. And so this is a kind of this mixes the Guantanamo material with other material. You live in Kandahar. Isn't it kind of dangerous for Westerners these days?
Yes, I mean, the security situation in Kandahar is extremely dire, and it is dangerous to an extent, but then one has to remember there are hundreds and thousands of people living there, and we live with Afghans, we live with our Afghan friends, and
what are you doing there?
We're researchers, as you said, and we're trying to understand the local conflict, and we're looking into the history of southern Afghanistan, specifically the 80s, and what happened there, since we think and we feel and we see that every day, how influential that time was to what we see right now on the ground.
I guess the question most of us would have is, right now we've been reading about fighting in the general area, and I wonder if it isn't just dangerous for you whether you're a Westerner or not.
Absolutely, and that's definitely we may be living there, but the Afghans who live there and the general population face these things on a daily basis, whether it's assassinations or bombs or whatever. And you know, we have the luxury of a foreign passport; we can leave at any time. But the Afghans who live there can't.
The writer of the book, Abdul Salam Zaif, has lived through so much of the turmoil of the last 30 years in Afghanistan. Alex, could you just sketch a brief outline of his life and the various roles that he's played during those years?
I mean, the first important kind of seismic event for him, and we have to remember that he is representative of so many people in southern Afghanistan, was the 1980s invasion by the Soviet Union.
How old was he?
He started fighting when he was 15 in 1983, back in Afghanistan, but people left the country and went to Pakistan. Then he came back, as I said, when he was 15, started fighting together with all of the people who we now know as the Taliban leadership, all of these very prominent figures. They were all involved during the 1980s.
Well, but he had to choose which group to fight with, didn't he, Felix? He could have joined any number of Mujahideen groups.
Absolutely. There was a great number of different Mujahideen groups, specifically locally, based. And he chose to go to a group which identified itself back then in the 80s and was also called by others the Taliban. It is still the same group of people we often hear about right now, who formed the Quetta Shura, the leadership council of the Taliban. And he chose to go there because, he obviously his father was an imam. He was a religious scholar, and he was raised in that religion, so he felt he wanted to pursue that, and that was part of that front of the Taliban, that they would pursue their studies while they were fighting at the same time.
Doesn't Taliban mean student?
It means, yes, I mean religious.
We're talking about a lot of old students.
Yes, yes. No,
exactly. But I guess it means students of the religion, no matter how old you are.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it depends. What you can graduate from Talib to Mullah to Maulawi. There are different kind of stages.
You describe the book as a cautionary tale for anyone seeking to simplify southern Afghanistan. It must have been very difficult for you to even simplify the book enough to make it accessible to the general reader of the West.
I mean, that was a definite problem, and Felix talked a little bit about this cultural translation that we engaged in. I mean, the original text had 30 names a page and lots of place names and contexts and foreign language terms. And if you're not immersed in studying this already, it's going to be very difficult to make head or tail of what's going on in this book.
The notes include a list of characters that goes on for several pages, even more than a Tolstoyan novel.
Exactly, but I mean, that's very much the nature of local Kandahari society. It's personal one-on-one relationships, it's networks of people, it's different groups, and if you want to understand, if you want to get to the bottom of what's going on, you really have to pay attention to all of these details, and that's why we felt it was so important to keep them included.
My guests are Alex Strick von Linschoten and Felix Kuhn, who are the editors of My Life with the Taliban, which is the autobiography of Abdul Salam Zaif. It's published by Columbia University Press. What are the most significant ways that his story differs from the standard accounts of Afghanistan since 1979, Felix?
In a way, there are not too many things which are different in his personal account, because even though he's a founding member of the Taliban and was a prominent member of the movement, a lot of the experiences he describes are actually very common and shared by a lot of our friends down in southern Afghanistan who had the same experiences and went through the same events in a way. Like the times of being refugees in Pakistan, for example, is something shared by most people in southern Afghanistan. I think there are several issues, obviously, which he chose not to talk about a lot. One has to remember that Mullah Zaif lives in Kabul. He's still in the country, and this is his story still touches up on what's happening right now in the country, and talking about everything might endanger his life.
Doesn't he bring a partisan's view to the retelling of these events? Do you feel his version of the story is an accurate depiction of what really went on?
I think in a lot of ways it is, yeah. In a lot of ways we also don't have any way to check. We tried our best and did several background interviews in southern Afghanistan, meeting friends of his and other people who were part or were in the same places at the time. So a lot of times we found that was a very accurate account given by him, by many other people, and we found very little which was differed from other people's view.
Well, aren't you living in the center of the Taliban area of influence when the Taliban were ruling Afghanistan? Didn't Mullah Omar live in Kandahar, not in Kabul?
Absolutely, and I mean it's still very much an important center of influence for them, and a goal for them to retain that influence.
Because this is the center of the Pashtun culture in Afghanistan.
People living in eastern Afghanistan might disagree, but certainly Pashtuns from Kandahar have a very strong sense of pride, and even you might call it superiority. Over other areas, yeah.
Goes a little bit back to Afghanistan's history. A lot of the groups who have traditionally ruled Afghanistan are from tribes from southern Afghanistan, from Kandahar and the region. So they have this national idea that they founded the state, they founded Afghanistan, and it belongs to them in a way.
Although there's also something unnatural about boundaries here, isn't there? Because the Pashtun live almost equally in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and you could actually carve out a country called
Pashtunistan.
Doesn't that complicate the situation? Is that one of the reasons why that the Taliban actually start in Pakistan and then wind up in Afghanistan?
I mean, if we look at Mullah Abdul Salam Saif's account, the Taliban actually started in Kandahar, in Afghanistan. And what we hear right now in the common media, we hear about Taliban in Pakistan and Taliban in Afghanistan, but it's actually quite distinct different groups. It's not the same group. It's different leaderships. It's different tribal backgrounds as well.
They're just using the same name? Are there no links?
There are definitely links in a way that they are in a common area, and they definitely have probably common grounds in a way. But if you look at the history, if you look at the actual tribes and what their connections are, they are actually quite distinct. And also in terms of what they're doing and what they're aiming for.
You write that the book isn't intended to serve as a history of Afghanistan or the region, but isn't it difficult to read it in any other way, considering how much history is involved in Zaev's life?
I mean, you definitely need to bring the history and all of the context in. But one of the things about the book is Mullah Zaev very rarely talks about things that he wasn't himself directly involved in or present in. I mean, that's a reflection of his life.
When he became involved in the Mujahideen, the Taliban Mujahideen, and the fight against the Soviets in the 1980s, you say he was just a teenager, 15 years old. Were his motivations totally religious?
For many people, yes, it was about jihad. The call was that Islam was under threat, and certainly for people like the Taliban, that was an important motivation. But at the same time, you had a very strong nationalist impulse as well, and the feeling that these were foreigners who had come to mess with our traditions, and there needed to be a response to that, and that was also part of the narrative.
Was it just that they were foreigners, or also that the government that they were supporting was more secular than some religious people might have wanted?
Yes, of course. I mean, the communist government in Kabul actually very early on started to implement things like the land reform and brought sort of like an urban culture from the cities into the rural villages.
They were also making life easier for women, weren't they?
The communist regime.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look into to life in the cities underneath the communist regime, and before that, it was very different. But if you look at life in the villages, actually, that had been very untouched, and was a very very different situation for women in the rural areas from the urban areas.
So, are the Taliban largely a rurally inspired group?
I think we could definitely talk about a rural movement. I mean, one of the big themes of understanding Afghanistan is this divide between the urban and the rural. And the Taliban, particularly during the 1990s, very much came to represent that kind of rural influence, particularly when they went into somewhere like Kabul. One of the reasons for the problems were that it was this rural group trying to impose their way and that their attitudes over the urban population.
Although, as I understand it, in the early days, the Taliban were welcomed by many people who may later have regretted their presence because they brought order and stability to a situation that was totally chaotic.
Absolutely. I mean, the situation in southern Afghanistan in the early 90s was anarchy. There were multiple different groups, militias, criminals, setting up posts along the roads. It wasn't possible for villagers to go to the city. People were getting raped, killed, extorted on a level that really disrupted life in any kind of sense. So having a new force, and they had tried to come to an arrangement, and it didn't work time and time again. And a new force like the Taliban was really seen as maybe these people can bring some form of stability back to something which was completely out of control.
Were they less corrupt than their predecessors? Now they're involved in the drug trade, and we've heard all sorts of stories of hypocrisy, the Mullah Omar having all sorts of things in his home that were forbidden for other people, for example. There was sexual abuse and the like. Were the Taliban all that much better than what preceded them?
Difficult question. I think in one way they were, in another they weren't. If you look at the original small group which started out, which also had like relatively limited goals, I think these people were actually quite pure in a way, and had like a very solid founding in Islam and wanted stability and did that in kind of an uncorruptible way. But that was only in the initial few weeks. I mean, this movement completely spun out of control, got a lot of influences from outside, from places like Pakistan and so forth, and they became a national movement, more or less, which was all that comes with that. A lot of new people, a lot of people who come in for power, who have different ideas, and then there was an element of corruption and a lot of outsiders all of a sudden.
And where does Abdul Salam Zaif fit into all of this? He's a member of the original core group.
Yeah, and he was one of the founding members. He was relatively young when he met all of these people, but by the 1990s he was very much involved, as he talks about in the book, in these initial discussions which took place over many months prior to the outburst of this thing that we call the Taliban.
We will come back to that and other aspects of Abdul Salam Zaib's history and the history of Afghanistan over the last 30 years as we continue this conversation with Alex Strick von Linschoten and Felix Kuhn, who are the editors of Mullah Zaif. His autobiography called My Life with the Taliban, published by Columbia University Press. We're back with Alex Strick von Linschoten and Felix Kuhn, the editors of My Life with the Taliban from Columbia University Press, the autobiography of Abdul Salam Zaif. What roles did he play in the various Taliban governments?
From 1994 to 2001, he was involved in really quite a wide variety of official positions. Ranging from working in the banking industry to reforming the transport sector to the Ministry of Mines and Industries, really all sorts of different positions.
Now he's very young, wasn't he?
Absolutely, and I mean, I think the fact that he was being shifted around through all of these different positions is indicative of something Felix was talking about earlier about this, the fact that the movement expanded almost beyond their ability to govern the country, and so if anyone showed a kind of a vague capacity to change things and move things forward with the administration, then they were moved around and shifted around in that way.
Well, he must have been greatly respected because he became the ambassador to Pakistan, probably the key diplomatic post at the time.
Absolutely. I mean, that he became the face of the movement, more or less, the first point of call, so to say, for anyone who wanted to talk or wanted to say something to the Taliban. Ironically, he didn't really know that he would be appointed. He learned about it listening to the radio. Mullah Muhammad Omar basically took that decision unilaterally and said, okay, you're going to be the ambassador. And we learn a lot about his relationship to the movement in a way, where at several times he kind of withdrew and tried to go home, like specifically what Alex talked about when he was at the Ministry of Defense. He was tasked with putting together a list of Afghans who received the Medal of Honor during the Soviet wars. So that list obviously would go towards putting these people to justice, and he didn't really like that and really wanted to withdraw and resigned in a way from his post.
Where was he when the 9/11 attacks happened?
He was in Islamabad. At the embassy.
So he was, at that moment, he was in a very important position, central diplomatic role. What was his take on it?
He, along with many other people in the Taliban, were shocked by it. And he relates in the book how while some of the people who he was with at the time were very happy about it and they saw it as a kind of overjoyed about this. He was very sad, and you know, he put out this statement. More or less immediately, about the Taliban condemned the attacks and so on.
But he also must have been aware that the U.S. was likely to invade his country as a consequence.
Absolutely, but we shouldn't forget that there already had been massive discussions about Osama bin Laden and Al Qaeda prior to the 9/11 attacks. And he was involved in like discussions surrounding this, but he actually in his book, when it comes to the actual moment, I think he described himself as being crying because he knew that eventually the Afghanistan would have to suffer for this.
Barnett Rubin of New York University wrote the foreword. He says there that readers may be frustrated with Zaif's many silences. For example, he says very little about Al Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Were you frustrated by those silences as well? Did you try to get him to talk more about those things?
Obviously, we asked him to approach this, but we also have to remember that this is a personal account of his experiences and his life, and it just doesn't come out from his experiences that he was involved in these with these figures in a direct way. In the negotiations part, yes, I mean, he writes for pages on pages about the discussions with America and Saudi Arabia over the possibility of extraditing Osama bin Laden at least 2 years prior to the 9/11 attacks.
But it didn't happen. Was he a supporter of that idea? Did he see Osama bin Laden's presence as a danger to the Taliban government?
He doesn't say it directly in such straightforward words, but there was a relatively large group of people within the Taliban movement who were concerned about the presence of outsiders and foreigners and what it might do to the legitimacy of the Taliban government.
Well, didn't the Al-Qaeda represent a different concept of Islam from what the Taliban believed in?
Yes, pretty much they do. I mean, Al-Qaeda, if you look at the simple composition of who are people in Al-Qaeda, who was the leadership council, who is the leadership council, there are people with a very, very different background there. They hold university degrees and so forth, while the Taliban were all rural people with very little education, and they stem from an Islam which is more close to the Deoband school and the Hanafi school of Islamic school of law, Salafism and Al-Qaeda and so forth comes from a very different angle and has a particularly different view.
But it's my sense Taliban is a rather fundamentalist approach to Islam. What was his take on the education of girls, for example?
I mean, he writes in the book and he has stated a number of times that the Taliban government wanted to introduce education of girls, and in fact the movement made various statements to this effect. But that because they were internationally isolated, they didn't have the funds to change the schools and the buildings and so on to allow for that.
Do you think that's true? Right now, the Taliban attack schools that teach girls. He's not associated with the Taliban.
No, he's currently not associated with the Taliban. I mean, obviously, the Taliban are not an isolated group. They're part of the Afghan society. Always someone's brother, someone's cousin. If we live in southern Afghanistan, there more or less every family will have somebody who's currently with the Taliban. I think I believe it when he says that he sees it that way concerning women's rights and girls and that status. Do I think that the Taliban at large see it this way? I think there are a lot of different people right now and a lot of different groups and a lot of people who are far more hardline than they used to be back in the 80s and 90s.
Well, women's education had existed before the Taliban came to power. We're talking about Abdul Salam Zaif and his autobiography called My Life with the Taliban, which is published by Columbia University Press. I'm talking with the book's two editors, Alex Strick von Linschoten and Felix Kuhn. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So what happened after the Taliban government fell? What happened to Zaif?
He spent several months in Islamabad holding the now infamous kind of press conferences to the international media. Once the government itself fell in November, December, he was more or less under house arrest by the Pakistani government, and it was on January the 2nd that the Pakistani secret services handed him over to American forces to be transported to various detention centers.
Does he talk at all about Pakistan's role in the Taliban victory and then its support of the Taliban?
There's not too much in the book, but you can read it between the lines. He says that he hasn't had too much contact, but then again, when he came to Pakistan, became the ambassador, we learn a lot about how he tried to distance himself from the ISI and not be entangled into their web and so forth. So there was that element of him being very conscious about the ISI and their involvement.
Do you think that the Taliban leadership saw him as a moderating figure, and is that why he was given the diplomatic post? Because he might present something more acceptable to people outside of Afghanistan?
I think the reason why he was chosen, because there were various ties and links to the movement. He'd fought with all of these people since the 1980s, and he had a very good relationship with Mullah Omar. He was seen as reliable, and he'd taken the oath to Mullah Omar, which was extremely important, which 40 to 50 people took in 1994. He was seen as someone who could toe the line, I guess.
So the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence, handed him over to the U.S. and he wound up at Guantanamo?
Yes, he spent over 3.5 years in Guantanamo Bay.
Well, yeah. since it was clear that he was a member of the Taliban, why was he released by the Bush administration after just 3.5 years when so many other people whose connection remains questionable continued to be held in the prison?
Very interesting question. I mean, there have been approaches from people within Afghanistan and the Afghan government after it was formed who tried to release him. I think from the administration, the American administration and the Afghan government, they both regarded him as what they termed to be a moderate Taliban who would be in a position to facilitate talks in a way and transmit information. I think that all things were that played towards that end. But in the end, he also was, you know, he was on an international diplomatic passport in Pakistan, and he wasn't involved in a lot of the things we are talking about right now.
Such as the 9/11 attacks.
Well, the fear many people had is, well, if you release people who were connected to the Taliban, they're just going to go back to the Taliban and engage in new jihadist activities.
But in terms of, you know, American domestic security, the Taliban have very little... offer relatively little direct threat to that. You know, they've never made statements saying that they want to come to America and kill Americans. They're very much a kind of localized group, and definitely in terms of the Taliban, we have to remember that it's not this national security threat for the United States.
Well, doesn't Zaev think that the concept of moderate and hardline Taliban is a false one?
Yes, absolutely. We had several conversations to this end with him, and he has commented that in the media as well, that he doesn't believe there is such a thing, and he thinks it's dangerous and to try to split the movement in that way, fractioning it into different groups, which in a way, you know, you if you think about it, could make sense, because right now at the current time, if we only manage to draw out certain kind of groups. And there is no such thing as a central leadership. We're probably always going to face a splinter group who will continue to fight.
The city of Kandahar is almost a character in this book. What does Kandahar mean to the Afghan people, not just to the Pashtun, but to all the Afghan people?
It really depends who you talk to, and that's one of the themes, I guess, of Afghanistan, that there are lots of different groups with lots of different opinions. Of things.
Is it much more regional than we imagine it to be?
Very much so. I mean, even more further down to a local level. If you talk to people in almost anywhere outside Kandahar, they'll make a face when you say, you know, I live in Kandahar, as if this is the most dangerous thing you could possibly do. People in Kandahar don't see it this way at all, and they see Kabul as a kind of more decadent place. And yeah.
Well, whenever I hear news reports that describe areas of Afghanistan as being tribal, alarm bells go off, because that word tribal always has really complicated meanings. But is that a fair assessment?
It's one of the words that you could use to describe what's going on. It really depends what you mean by it. In terms of the tribe's influence, yes, there is an influence, but it's not as extensive as maybe it is in the East in terms of the ability to bring things to happen.
So would warlord be a better way of describing somebody who'd be a local leader than a tribal chief?
Probably not when it comes to southern Afghanistan necessarily. A warlord is something which is more indigenous to northern Afghanistan, actually. In southern Afghanistan, it's probably wiser to talk about tribes. But there has been a replacement of the traditional tribal leadership in the 80s, where new mujahideen came in with lots of money and guns and took over the traditional leadership from other from the leaders beforehand, and that kind of makes them not the kind of political class that used to be the political leadership of the tribes. So there is a difference in terms of who these people are right now.
Saif says that no other place on earth will ever mean as much to him as Kandahar, but he's living in Kabul these days.
Yeah, I mean, he wants very much. He would like nothing more, I imagine, to be able to live peacefully in his village back in Kandahar. But he's been advised by various people that it would be too dangerous for him to go back.
Why? Because he's written a book like this and that will have angered some people, of his old friends?
It's a mixture of a whole number of things. Obviously, at the moment, his name is frequently dropped with reference to negotiations between the government and the Taliban. And in that way, there are all sorts of people who would like nothing better than to kill him to stop to prevent that kind of thing.
Let's talk about those negotiations. Last month, Hamid Karzai announced a new strategy to pursue negotiations with Taliban leaders as part of a broader effort to end the war. The plan has come under a lot of criticism. Do you think that it has any chance of succeeding?
I think just recently, about like a day ago, we all learned that the second-in-command, Mullah Barde, was caught by the Pakistan intelligence service. And I think that sets a very different picture for high-level negotiations right now. We actually lost more or less the person to negotiate with, since Mullah Omar is very inaccessible. And it's also kind of unclear in how far he would be a person to talk to directly.
On the other hand, hasn't he been reported to be very cooperative?
Mullah brother?
With the interrogators in Pakistan?
There are various different reports which are coming out. Who knows? I mean, we could speculate all day, but...
Yeah. We've also heard lately the phrase $10 Taliban to describe those who could be turned away from radicalism simply through economic incentives, the sort of thing that we saw in Iraq. What are your thoughts on that?
The idea that the Taliban are an economically fueled insurgency, I think, has relatively little to support it. Certainly, it's not ideological either. In southern Afghanistan, you only have 10 or 15% of the people are fighting for ideological reasons. But the idea that the Taliban are getting a salary from the movement and all of this kind of thing, it's just wrong.
We keep on hearing that Taliban fighters are paid better than the Afghan military.
We have been hearing that for a few years now, and time again, people pick up on these stories.
You say it's not true?
But it's in terms of, I can speak for what I know, and I know we know Kandahar and the province, and there we have never really met any fighters or relatives of fighters who have been talking about that they got or received a salary or were fighting for that reason, actually.
In a Washington Post story on February 4th, Zaif was quoted as saying, "There's no clear strategy for negotiations. The Taliban were deceived many times. They will not be deceived again and again. They need concrete guarantees." What kinds of guarantees are we talking about here?
Mainly, it's in terms of security for their people to negotiate and so on. And
what would they want? Would they want to return to power? I mean, would that be acceptable to anybody other than the Taliban and some members of the Pakistani secret police?
I don't think there's any illusion at the moment that the Taliban want to return to power and take over the whole country, certainly within the Taliban movement. And just to go back to this security guarantees thing, the capture of Mullah Baradar really goes to exactly that point, which he was saying. You know, this guy was the key node, I guess, between various people, and now he's being captured. What is it, negotiations or it's war? You know, we sent 30,000 troops down there. Which is it?
So are you suggesting that we shouldn't have captured this key figure in the Taliban? We're at war with the Taliban, aren't we?
Yeah, we are at war with the Taliban, and we're winning every single fight. But unfortunately, we're managing to losing that war while we're winning the fights. And the country's slipping more and more out of our control. And actually, most of the experts have realized that there is no military solution to the problem. We are in a political conflict here. And a political conflict needs a political solution. The military probably isn't the right instrument to actually engage on that level. And when it comes to how many people would accept the Taliban back in power, if you look into southern Afghanistan, into Kandahar, a lot of people would actually welcome that. They're using the Taliban courts right now at the moment because there are no services. There is no government out in the local districts. There is no outreach and there is no security. And the Taliban are the closest thing they get to having any of this.
My guests have been Felix Kuhn and Alex Strick von Linschoten. They are the editors of My Life with the Taliban, the autobiography of Abdul Salam Zaif, published by Columbia University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.